this time.
Oh, it's time for Gremlin Time. We are finally here. This is Fortunato. We seem to wait all year for this time of year. When the leaves are falling, the wind is whistling through the bare tree limbs, the sun's low in the sky. So for tonight, I've got a couple of stories lined up. First off, we're going to have a classic, a macabre, a classic of the macabre, actually. Published 1912 by William Hope Hodgson, a purely creative, potent masterpiece of the macabre, set millions of years in the future when the sun has gone out. This is The Nightland. This is a big novel, and I'm just going to read, I'm going to start in the second chapter, which has some nice descriptive passages of the great redoubt where the remnants of mankind have sheltered against all the monsters that surround the last structure, the last city, or the last hope of mankind. The premise of the story is that the narrator had a love affair, and they were very intense, and she dies, and now he finds that he's dreaming about living in this far, far, far future after the sun's gone out. And he dreams that he lives in that future, but he still is aware of his present day situation. And he's like two people, but they're the same. And he kind of goes on a lot trying to explain that, which nowadays we can kind of get. But this is, of course, 1912 when he wrote this, a very influential book on a lot of writers like Howard Philip Lovecraft and Clark Aston Smith and Ray Bradbury and certainly Stephen King and many others. So this is from chapter 2 of The Nightland by William Hope Hodgson. In my earliest knowledge of that place, I was a youth, 17 years grown. And my memory tells me that when I first wakened, or came, as it might be said, to myself in that future, I stood in one of the embrasures of the last redoubt, the great pyramid of gray metal, which held the last millions of this world from the powers of the slayers. And so full am I of the knowledge of that place, that scarce can I believe that none here know. And because I have such difficulty, it may be that I speak over familiarity of those things of which I know, and heed not to explain much that is needed that I should explain to those who must read here in this our present day. For there, as I stood and looked out, I was less the man of years of this age than the youth of that. With the natural knowledge of that life there, though, until that my first vision, I, of this age, knew not of that other and future existence, yet woke to it so naturally as may a man wake here in his bed in the shining of the morning sun and know it by name and the meaning of aught else. And yet, as I stood there, in the vast embrasure, I had also a knowledge or memory of this present life of ours deep down within me, but touched with a halo of dreams and yet with a conscious longing for one, known even there in a half memory as my beloved Meredith. As I have said in my earliest memory, I mind that I stood in an embrasure high up in the side of the pyramid and looked outwards through a queer spyglass to the northwest. I, full of youth and with an adventurous and yet half fearful heart, and in my brain was, as I have told, the knowledge that had come to me in all the years of my life in the redoubt. And yet, until that moment, the man of this present time had no knowledge of that future existence. And now I stood and had suddenly the knowledge of a life already spent in that strange land, and deeper within me, the misty knowings of this our present age, and maybe also of some others. To the northwest, I looked through the queer spyglass and saw a landscape that I had looked upon and pored upon through all the years of that life, so that I knew how to name this thing and that thing, and give the very distances of each and every one from the center point of the pyramid, which was that which had neither length nor breadth, and was made of polished metal in the room of mathematics, where I went daily to my studies. To the northwest I looked, and in the wide field of my glass saw plain the bright glare of the fire from the red pit shine upwards against the underside of the vast chin of the northwest watcher, the watching thing of the northwest, that which hath watched from the beginning and until the opening of the gateway of eternity, came into my thoughts. As I looked through the glass, the words of Ainsworth, the ancient poet, though incredibly future to this our time, and suddenly there seemed at fault, for I looked deep down into my being and saw, as dreams are seen, the sunlight and the splendor of this our present age, and I was amazed. And here I must make it clear to all that even as I waked from this age suddenly into that life, so must I, that youth there in the embrasure, have awakened to the knowledge of this far back life of ours, seeming to him a vision of the very beginnings of eternity in the dawn of the world. Oh, I do but dread I make it not sufficiently clear that I and he were both I, same soul, he of that far date seeing vaguely the life that was, that I do not live in the present age, and I of this time beholding the life that I have yet shall live. How utterly strange! And yet I do not know that I speak holy truth to say that I, in that future time, had no knowledge of this life and age before that awakening, for I awoke to find I was one who stood apart from the other youths, in that I had a dim knowledge, visionary as it were, of the past, which confounded, whilst yet it angered those who were the men of learning of that age. Though of this matter more anon, but this I do know, that from that time onwards my knowledge and assuranceness of the past was tenfold, for this my memory of that life told me. And so, to further my telling, yet before I pass onwards, one other thing is there of which I shall speak. In the moment in which I wakened out of that youthfulness into the assured awareness of this our age, in that moment the hunger of this my love flew to me across the ages, so that what had really been but a momentary memory dream grew to the pain of reality, and I knew suddenly that I lacked. And from that time onwards I went, listening, as it were, listening, as even now my life is spent. And so it was that I, fresh born in that future time, hungered strangely for my beautiful one with all the strength of that new life, knowing that she had been mine and might live again, even as I. And so, as I have said, I hungered and found that I listened. And now, to go back from my digression, it was as if I had said I had amazement at perceiving in memory the unknowable sunshine and splendor of this age breaking so clear through my hitherto most vague and hazy visions, so that the ignorance of Ainsworth was shouted to be by the things which now I knew. And from that time onward, for a little space, I was stunned with all that I knew and guessed and felt, and all of a long while the hunger grew for that one I had lost in the early days, she who had sung unto me in those fairy days of light that had been in veracity. And the especially thoughts of that age looked back with a keen, regretful wonder in the gulf of forgetfulness. But presently I turned from the haze and pain of my dream memories once more to the inconceivable mystery of the nightland, which I viewed through the great embrasure. For on none did it ever come with weariness to look out upon all the hideous mysteries, so that old and young watched, from early years to death, the black monstrosity of the nightland, which this, our last refuge of humanity, held at bay. To the right of the red pit, there lay a long, sinuous glare, which I knew as the veil of red fire. And beyond that, for many dreary miles, the blackness of the night land, across which came the coldness of the light from the plain of blue fire. And then, on the very borders of the unknown lands, there lay a range of low volcanoes which lit up far away in the outer darkness, the Black Hills, where shone the seven lights, which neither twinkled nor moved nor faltered through eternity, and of which even the great spyglass could make no understanding, nor had any adventurer from the pyramid ever come back to tell us aught of them. And here let me say that down in the great library of the redoubt were the histories of all of those who had ventured out into the monstrousness of the night land, risking not the life only, but the spirit of life. And surely it is all so strange and wonderful to set out, that I could almost despair with the contemplation of that which I must achieve, for there is so much to tell, and so few words given to man by which he may make clear that which lies beyond the sight and the present and general knowings of peoples. How shall you ever know, as I verify, of the greatness and reality and terror of the thing that I would tell plain to all? For we, with our puny span of recorded life, must have great histories to tell, but the few bare details we know concerning years that are but a few thousand in all. And I must set out to you in the short pages of this my life there, a sufficiency of the life that I had been and the life that was, both within and without the mighty pyramid, to make clear to those who may read the truth of that which I would tell, and the histories of that great redoubt dealt not with odd thousands of years, but with very millions. I, away back into what they of the age conceived to be the early days of Earth, when the sun, maybe, still gloomed dully in the night sky of the world, but for all that went before, nothing save as myths and matters to be taken most cautiously and believed not by men of sanity and proven wisdom. And I, how shall I make all this clear to you who may read? The thing cannot be, yet I must tell my history. For to be silent before so much wonder would be to suffer of too much a heart. And I must ever ease my spirit by this my struggle to tell to all how it was with me and how it will be. Aye, even to the memories which were the possession of that far future youth, who was indeed I of his childhood days, when his nurse of the age swung him and crooned impossible lullabies of this mythical sun, which, according to those future fairy tales, had once passed across the blackness that now lay above the great pyramid. Such is the monstrous futureness of this which I have seen through that body of the far-off youth. And so back to my telling, to my right, which was to the north, there stood very far away the House of Silence upon a low hill. And in that house were many lights and no sounds. And so had it been through an uncountable eternity of years. Always those steady lights and no whisper of sound, not even such as our distant microphones could have discovered. And the danger of this house was accounted the greatest danger to all those lands. And round of the House of Silence wound the road where the silent ones walk. And concerning this road, which passed out of the unknown lands, nigh by the place of the Abhumans, where was always the green, luminous mist, nothing was known, save that it was held that of all the works about the mighty pyramid, it was alone the one that was bred long ages past of healthy human toil and labor. And on this point alone had 1,000 books and more been writ, and all contrary and so to no end as is ever the way in such matters. And as it was with the road where the silent ones walk, so it was with all those other monstrous things. Whole libraries had there been made about this and about that, and many 1,000,000,000 moldered into the forgotten dust of the earlier world. I minded me now that presently I stepped upon the central traveling roadway which spanned the 1,000 plateau of the Great Redoubt. And this lay 6 miles and 30 fathoms above the plain of the night land, and it was somewhat of a great mile or more across. And so in a few minutes I was at the southeastern border and looking out to the great embrasure towards the 3 silver fire holes that shone before the thing that nods away down far in the southeast. Southward of this, but nearer, there rose the vast bulk of the southeast watcher, the watching thing of the southeast. And to the right and to the left of the squat monster burned the torches, maybe 1/2 mile above each side, yet sufficient light they threw to show the lumbered forward head of the never-sleeping brute. To the east, as I stood there in the quietness of the sleeping time on the 1,000th plane, I heard a far dreadful sound down in the lightless east, and presently began a strange, dreadful laughter, deep as a low thunder upon the mountains. And because this sound came odd whiles from the unknown lands beyond the Valley of the Hounds, we had named that far and never seen place the country which comes the great laughter. And though I had heard the sound many and oft a time, yet did I never hear it without a most strange thrilling of my heart, and a sense of my littleness, and of the utter terror which had beset the last millions of the world. Yet, because I had heard that laughter oft, I paid not overlong attention to my thoughts upon it. And when in a little it died away into that eastern darkness, I turned my spyglass upon the giant's kilns, and these same kilns were tended by the giants, and the light of the kilns was red and fitful, and threw wavering shadows and lights across the mouth of the pit, so that I saw giants crawling up out of the pit, but not properly seen by reason of the dance of the shadows. And so, because ever there was so much to behold, I looked away presently to that which was plainer to be examined. to the back of the giant's pit was a great black headland that stood vast between the valley of the hounds, where lived the monstrous night hounds, and the giants. And the light of the kilns struck the brow of this black headland so that constantly I saw things peer over the edge, coming forward a little into the light of the kilns and drawing back swiftly into the shadows. And thus it had been ever, through the uncounted ages, so that the headland was known as the headland from which strange things peer. And thus was it marked in our maps and charts of that grim world. And so I could go on ever, but that I feared to weary, and yet, whether I do weary or not, I must tell of this country that I see, even now, as I set my thoughts down so plainly that my memory wanders into a hushed and secret fashion along its starkness and amid its strange and dreadful inhabitants, so that it is but by an effort I realize that my body is not there in this very moment, that I write, and so the further tellings. Before me ran the road where the silent ones walked, and I searched it, as many a time in my earlier youth had I, with the spyglass, for my heart was always stirring mightily for the sight of those silent ones. And presently, alone in the miles of that night-gray road, I saw one, in the field of my glass, a quiet, cloaked figure moving along, shrouded, and looking neither to right nor left. And thus was it with these beings ever. It was told about in the redoubt that they would harm no human, if but the human did keep a fair distance from them, but that it were wise never to come close upon one, and thus I can well believe. And so, searching the road with my gaze, I passed beyond this silent one, and passed the place where the road, sweeping vastly to the southeast, was lit a space strangely by the light from the silver fire holes, and thus at last to where it swayed to the south of the dark place, and thus, and thence, southward still, until it passed round to the westward, beyond the mountain bulk of the watching thing in the south, the hugest monster of all the visible nightlands. My spyglass showed it to me was, with clearness, a living hill of watchfulness, known to us as the Watcher of the South. It brooded there, squat and tremendous, hunched over the pale radiance of the glowing dome. Much, I know, had been writ concerning this odd, vast watcher, for it had grown out of the blackness of the south unknown lands a million years gone, and the steady growing nearness of it had been noted and set out at length by the men they called Monstruwalkens, so that it was possible to search in our libraries and learn of the very coming of this beast in the olden time. And, well, I mind me, there were even then and always men named Monstruwalkens, whose duty it was to take heed of the great forces and to watch the monsters and the beasts that beset the great pyramid, and measure and record and have so full a knowledge of these same that did one but stray ahead in the darkness, the same matter was set down with particularness in the records. And so to tell more about the South Watcher, a million years gone, as I have told, came it out from the blackness of the South and grew steadily nearer through 20,000 years. But so slow that in no one year could a man perceive that it had moved. Yet it had movement, and had come thus far upon its road to the redoubt, when the glowing dome, rose out of the ground before it, growing slowly. And this had stayed the way of the monster, so that through an eternity it had looked towards the pyramid, across the pale glare of the dome, and seeming to have no power to advance nearer. Because of this, much had been written to prove that there were other forces than evil at work in the night lands about the great redoubt. And this I have always thought to be wisely said, and indeed there to be no doubt to the matter, for there were many things in the time of which I have knowledge, which seemed to make clear that even as the forces of darkness were loose upon the end of man, so were there other forces out to do battle with the terror, though in ways most strange and unthought of by the human mind. And of this I shall have more to tell anon. And here, before I go further with my telling, let me set out some of that knowledge which yet remains so clear within my mind and heart. Of the coming of these monstrosities and evil forces, no man could say much and verify, for the evil of it began before the histories of the great redoubt were shaped, aye, even before the sun had lost all power to light, though. It must be a thing of certainty that even at this far time, the invisible black heavens held no warmth for this world. But of this I have no room to tell, and must pass on to that which I have a more certain knowledge. The evil must surely have begun in the days of the darkening, which I might liken to a story which was believed doubtfully, much as we of this day believe the story of the creation. A dim record there was of olden sciences, and that are yet far off in our future, which, disturbing the unmeasurable outward powers, had allowed to pass the barrier of life some of those monstrosities and abhuman creatures which are so wondrously cushioned from us at this normal present. And thus they are materialized, and in other cases developed grotesque and horrible creatures which now beset the humans of this world. And where there was no power to take on material form, there had been allowed to certain dreadful forces to have power to affect the life of the human spirit. And this growing very dreadful, the world full of lawlessness and degeneracy, there had banded together the sound millions and built the last redoubt there in the twilight of the world, so it seems to us, and yet to them, bred at last to the peace of usage, as it were the beginning. And this I can make no clearer, and none had right to expect it, for my task is very great and beyond the power of human skill. And when the humans had built the great pyramid, it had 1,320 floors, and the thickness of each floor was according to the strength of its need. And the whole height of this pyramid exceeded 7 miles by near a mile, and above it was a tower from which the watchmen looked, these being called the Monstruwakans. But where the redoubt was built, I know not, save that I believe in a mighty valley, of which I might tell more in due time. And when the pyramid was built, the last millions who were the builders thereof went within and made themselves a great house and city of this last redoubt, and thus the second history of this world. And how shall I set it all down in these little pages? For my task, even as I see it, it is too great for the power of a single life and a single pen. And later, though, hundreds and thousands of years, there grew up in the outer lands, beyond those which lay under the guard of the redoubt, mighty and lost races of terrible creatures, half men and half beast, and evil and dreadful, and these made war upon the redoubt, but were beaten off from that grim metal mountain with a vast slaughter. Yet, must there have been many such attacks until the electric circle was put around the pyramid and lit from the earth current, and the lowest half mile of the pyramid was sealed. And so, at last, there was a peace and the beginning of that eternity of quiet, watching for the day when the earth current shall become exhausted. And at whiles, through the forgotten centuries, had the creatures had been glutted time and again upon such odd bands of daring ones as had adventured forth to explore through the mystery of the night lands. For of those who went, scarce any did ever return, for there were eyes in all that dark, and powers and forces abroad, which had all knowledge, or so we must fain believe. And then, so it would seem, as that eternal night lengthened itself upon the world, the power of terror grew and strengthened, and fresh and greater monsters developed and bred out of all space and outward dimensions, attracted even as it were to be infernal sharks by that lonely and mighty hill of humanity fading its end so near to the eternal, and yet so far deferred in the minds and to the senses of those humans, and thus had it ever been. And all this, but on the way, and vague, ill-toed, and set out in despair, to make a little clear the beginnings of that state which is so strange to our conceptions, and yet which had become a condition of naturalness to humanity in that stupendous future. Thus had the giants come, fathered of bestial humans and mothered of monsters, and many and diverse were the creatures which some human semblance and intelligence, mechanical and cunning, so that certain of these lesser brutes had machinery and underground ways, having need to secure to themselves warmth and air, even as healthy humans, only that they were incredibly inured to hardship, as there might be wolves set in comparison with tender children. And surely do I make this thing clear. And now to continue my telling concerning the Nightland. The Watcher of the South was, as I have set to make known, a monster differing from those other watching things of which I have spoken, and of which there were in all four, one to the northwest and one to the southeast, and of these I have told. The other twain lay brooding, one to the southwest and the other to the northeast, and thus the four watchers kept ward through the darkness upon the pyramid, and moved not, neither gave they out any sound. Yet we know them to be mountains of living watchfulness and hideous and steadfast intelligence. And so in a while, having listened to the sorrowful sound which came ever to us over the gray dunes from the country of wailing, which lay to the south, midway between the redoubt and the Watcher of the South, I passed upon one of the moving roadways over the southwestern side of the pyramid and looked far down into the deep valley, which is 4 miles deep, and which was the pit of the red smoke. And the mouth of this pit was 1 full mile across, and the smoke of the pit filled the valley at times, so that it seemed but as a glowing red circle amid dull, thunderous clouds of redness. Yet the red smoke rose never much above the valley, so that there was clear sight across to the country beyond, and there, along the further edge of that great depth, were the towers, each maybe a mile high, gray and quiet, but with a shimmer upon them. Beyond these, south and west of them, was the enormous bulk of the Southwest Watcher, and from the ground rose what we call the I-beam, a single ray of gray light, which came out of the ground and lit the right eye of the monster. And because of this light, that eye had been mightily examined through unknown thousands of years, and some held that the eye looked through the light steadfastly at the pyramid, but others set out that the light blinded it and was the work of those other powers which were abroad to do combat with the evil forces. But however this may be, as I stood there in the embrasure and looked at the thing through the spy glass, it seemed to my soul that the brute looked strangely at me, unwinking and steadfast and fully of a knowledge that I spied upon it. And this is how I felt. To the north of this, in the direction of the west, I saw the place where the silent ones kill. And this was so named because there, maybe 10,000 years gone, certain humans adventuring from the pyramid came off the road where the silent ones walk and into that place, and were immediately destroyed. And this was told by one who escaped, though he died also very quickly, for his heart was frozen. And this I cannot explain, but so it was set out in the records. Far away beyond the place where the silent ones kill, in the very mouth of the western night, was the place of the abhumans, where was lost the road where the silent ones walk, in a dull, green, luminous mist, and of this place nothing was known, though much it held the thoughts and attentions of our thinkers and imagineers, for some said there was a place of safety, differing from the redoubt, as we of this day suppose heaven to differ from the earth, and that the road led thence, but was barred by the abhumans, and this I can only set down here, but with no thought to justify or uphold it. Later I traveled over the northeastern wall of the redoubt, and looked thence with my spyglass at the watcher of the northeast, the crowned watcher it was called, in that within the air above its vast head there hung always a blue luminous ring, which shed a strange light downwards over the monster, showing a vast wrinkled brow, upon which an whole library had been writ, but putting to the shadow all the lower face, all save the ear, which came out from the back of the head and belled towards the redoubt, and had been said of some observers in the past to have been seen to quiver. But how that might be, I knew not, for no man of our days had seen such a thing. And beyond the watching thing was the place where the silent ones are never. Close by the great road, which was bound upon the far side by the giant's sea, and upon the far side of that was a road which was always named the road by the quiet city. For it passed along that place where burned forever the constant and never-moving lights of a strange city. But no glass had ever shown life there, neither had any light ever ceased to burn. And beyond that again was the black mist. And here let me say that the Valley of the Hounds ended towards the light of the quiet city. And so I have set out something of that land and of those creatures and circumstances which
And that was our excerpt from The Nightland by William Hope Hogson. Let's see, it was published in 1912. It's a big two-volume book that was published by Ballantine Books in back in the 1970s. John Stoddard has a sort of retell of it that he came out with in 2011, The Nightland, A Story Retold. And there's a recent collection of stories set in the same location called Awake in the Nightland. And there's also, I think, some games that can be found to play that are set in the Nightland, kind of like the stuff of H.P. Lovecraft. We'll be right back. Cable Community Radio is a proud sponsor of Flash. starting Thursday, November 7th, at the Clinton Street Theater in Portland. Flash returns for its fifth anniversary and the retirement of this live theater production. When the Earth is threatened with destruction by the planet Mongo, Flash Gordon attempts to save us. But Ming the Merciless, Emperor of Mongo, has other plans. This production runs from November 7th through November 17th, Friday and Saturday evenings at 7:30 p.m., Sunday matinees at 2 p.m. Again, that's Flash! November 7th through 17th at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information, including start times, special performances, and more, can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Oh, man, I forgot I recorded that. Up next, this is a story by Ray Bradbury. It was his first story that was published in a non-pulp paper magazine, Good Housekeeping, in this instance. The editor was Truman Capote, and he really liked this story, and this is one of the first ones of Ray Bradbury for him to break into mainstream writing, and this is called Night.
You are a child in a small town. You are, to be exact, 8 years old, and it is growing late at night. Late for you, accustomed to bedding in at 9 or 9:30. Once in a while, perhaps begging mom or dad to let you stay up later to hear Sam and Henry on that strange radio that is popular in this year of 1927. But most of the time, you are in bed and snug at this time of night. It is a warm summer evening. You live in a small house on a small street in the outer part of town, where there are a few streetlights. There is only one store open about a block away, Mrs. Singer's. In the hot evening, Mother has been ironing the Monday wash, and you have been intermittently begging for ice cream and staring into the dark. You and your mother are all alone at home in the warm darkness of summer. Finally, just before it is time for Mrs. Singer to close her store, Mother relents and tells you, "Run, get a pint of ice cream, and be sure she packs it tight." You ask if you can get a scoop of chocolate ice cream on top, because you don't like vanilla, and Mother agrees. You clutch the money and run barefooted over the warm evening cement sidewalk, under the apple trees and oak trees, toward the store. The town is so quiet and far off, you can only hear the crickets sounding in the spaces beyond the hot indigo trees that hold back the stars. Your bare feet slap the pavement. You cross the street and find Mrs. Singer moving ponderously about her store singing Yiddish melodies. "Pint ice cream," she says. "Chocolate on top, yes?" You watch her fumble the metal top off the ice cream freezer and manipulate the scoop, packing the cardboard pint chock full with "chocolate on top, yes?" You give the money, receive the chill, icy pack, and rubbing it across your brow and cheek, laughing, you thump barefootedly homeward. Behind you, the lights of the lonely little store blink out, and there's only a streetlight shimmering on the corner, and the whole city seems to be going to sleep. Opening the screen door, you find Mom still ironing. She looks hot and irritated, but she smiles just the same. "When will Dad be home from lodge meeting?" you ask. "About 11:30 or 12, Mother replies. She takes the ice cream to the kitchen, divides it. Giving you your special portion of chocolate, she dishes out some for herself, and the rest is put away. "For Skipper and your father when they come." Skipper is your brother. He is your older brother. He's 12 and healthy, red-faced, hawk-nosed, tawny-haired, broad-shouldered for his years, and always running. He's allowed to stay up later than you, not much later, but enough to make him feel it's worthwhile having been born first. He is over on the other side of town this evening to a game of kick the can, and will be home soon. He and the kids have been yelling, kicking, running for hours, having fun. Soon he will come clomping in, smelling of sweat and green grass on his knees where he fell, and smelling very much, in all ways, like Skipper, which is natural. You sit enjoying the ice cream. You are at the core of the deep, quiet summer night. Your mother and yourself and the night all around this small house on this small street. You lick each spoon of ice cream thoroughly before digging in for another. And Mom puts her ironing board away and the hot iron in its case, and she sits in the armchair by the phonograph, eating her dessert and saying,
"My lands, it was a hot day today. It's still hot." Earth soaks up all the heat and lets it out at night. It'll be soggy sleeping.
You both sit there listening to the summer silence. The dark is pressed down by every window and door. There is no sound because the radio needs a new battery, and you've played all the Knickerbocker Quartet records and Al Jolson and Two Black Crows records to exhaustion. So you sit on the hardwood floor by the door and look out into the dark, 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 pressing your nose against the screen until the flesh of its tip is molded into small, dark squares. I wonder where your brother is, Mother says after a while. He should be home by now. It's almost 9:30. He'll be here, you say, knowing very well that he will be. You follow Mom out to wash the dishes. Each sound, each rattle of spoon or dish is amplified in the baked evening. Silently, you go into the living room, remove the couch cushions, and together yank it open and extend it down to the double bed that it secretly is. Mother makes the bed, punching the pillows neatly to flump them up for your head. Then, as you are unbuttoning your shirt, she says,
"Wait a while, Doug."
"Why?"
"Because I say so. You look funny, Mom."
Mom sits down a moment and then stands up, goes to the door and calls. You listen to her calling and calling, "Skipper, Skipper, Skipper," over and over. Her calling goes out into the summer warm dark and never comes back. The echoes pay no attention.
"Skipper! Skipper! Skipper!"
As you sit on the floor, a coldness that is not ice cream and not winter and not part of summer's heat goes through you. You notice Mom's eyes sliding, blinking, the way she stands undecided and is nervous, all of these things. She opens the screen door, stepping out into the night. She walks down the steps and down the front sidewalk under the lilac bush. You listen to her moving feet. She calls again. Silence. She calls twice more. You sit in the room. Any moment now, Skipper will reply from down the long, long, narrow street. "All right, Mom. All right, Mother. Hey!" But he doesn't answer. And for 2 minutes, you sit looking at the made-up bed, the silent radio, the silent phonograph, at the chandelier with its crystal bobbins gleaming quietly, at the rug with the scarlet and purple curlicues on it. You stub your toe on the bed purposefully to see if it hurts. It does. Whining, the screen door opens and Mother says,
"Come on, Shorts, we'll take a walk."
"Where to?"
"Just down the block. Come on, better put your shoes on, though. You'll catch cold."
"No, I won't. I'll be all right."
You take her hand. Together, you walk down St. James Street. You smell roses in blossom, fallen apples lying crushed and odorous in the deep grass. Underfoot, the concrete is still warm, and the crickets are sounding louder against the darkening dark. You reach a corner, turn, and walk toward the ravine. Off somewhere, a car goes by, flashing its lights in the distance. There is such a complete lack of light and activity. Here and there, back off from where you are walking toward the ravine, you see faint squares of light where people are still up, but most of the houses, darkened, are sleeping already. And there are a few lightless places where the occupants of a dwelling sit talking low, dark talk on their front porches. You hear a porch swing, squeaking as you walk near.
"Wish your father was home," says Mother. Her large hand tightens around your small one. "Just wait till I get that boy. I'll spank him within an inch of his life."
A razor strop hangs in the kitchen for this. You think of it. Remember when Dad has doubled and flourished it with muscled control over your frantic limbs. You doubt Mother will carry out her promise. Now you have walked another block and are standing by the holy black silhouette of the German Baptist Church at the corner of Chapel Street and Glen Rock. In the back of the church, 100 yards away, the ravine begins. You can smell it. It has a dark sewer, rotten foliage, thick green odor. It is a wide ravine that cuts and twists across the town, a jungle by day, a place to let alone at night, Mother has often declared. You should feel encouraged by the nearness of the German Baptist Church, but you are not. Because the building is not illumined, is cold and useless as a pile of ruins on the ravine edge. You are only 8 years old. You know little of death, fear, or dread.
Death is the waxen effigy in the coffin when you were six and grandfather's passed away, looking like a great fallen vulture in his casket, silent, withdrawn, no more to tell you how to be a good boy, no more to comment succinctly on politics. Death is your little sister one morning. When you awaken at the age of seven, look into her crib and see her staring up at you with a blind, blue, fixed and frozen stare, until the men come with a small wicker basket to take her away. Death is when you stand by her high chair 4 weeks later and suddenly realize she'll never be in it again, laughing and crying and make you jealous of her because she was born. That is death. But this is more than death. This summer night, wading deep in time and stars and warm eternity, it is an essence of all the things you will ever feel or see or hear in your life again, being brought steadily home to you all at once. Leaving the sidewalk, you walk along a trodden, pebbled, weed-fringed path to the ravine's edge. Crickets in a loud, full, drumming chorus now are shouting to quiver the dead. You follow low, obediently behind brave, fine, tall mother who is defender of all the universe. You feel braveness because she goes before, and you hang back a trifle for a moment, and then hurry on too, together. Then you approach, reach, and pause at the very edge of civilization, the ravine. Here and now, down there, in that pit of jungled blackness, is suddenly all the evil you will ever know. Evil you will never understand. All of the nameless things are there. Later, when you have grown, you'll be given names to label them with meaningless syllables to describe the waiting nothingness. Down there in the huddled shadow among the thick trees and trailed vines lives the odor of decay. Here at this spot, civilization ceases, reason ends, and a universal evil takes over. You realize you are alone. You and your mother. Her hand trembles. Your belief in your private world is shattered. You feel mother tremble. Why? Is she too doubtful? But she is bigger, stronger, more intelligent than yourself, isn't she? Does she too feel that intangible menace, that groping out of the darkness, that crouching malignancy down below? Is there, then, no strength in growing up? No solace in being an adult? No sanctuary in life? No flesh citadel strong enough to withstand the scrabbling assault of midnights? Doubts flush you. Ice cream lives again in your throat, stomach, spine, and limbs. You are instantly cold as a wind out of December gone. You realize that all men are like this, that each person is to himself one alone, one oneness, a unit in a society, but always afraid, like here, standing. If you should scream now, if you should holler for help, would it matter? You are so close to the ravine now that in the instant of your scream, in the interval between someone hearing it and running to find you, much could happen. Blackness could come swiftly, swallowing, and in one titanically freezing moment, all would be concluded. Long before dawn, long before police with flashlights might probe the disturbed pathway, long before men with trembling brains could rustle down the pebbles to your help, even if they were within 500 yards of you now, and help certainly is, in 3 seconds, a dark tide could rise and take all 8 years of life away from you, and the essential impact of life's loneliness crushes your beginning to tremble body. Mother is alone, who? She cannot look to the sanctity of marriage, the protection of her family's love. She cannot look to the United States Constitution or the city police. She cannot look anywhere. In this instant, it is an individual problem seeking an individual solution. You must accept being alone and work on from there. You swallow hard, cling to her. Oh, Lord, don't let her die, please, you think. Don't do anything to us. Father will be coming home from lodge meeting in an hour, and if the house is empty... Mother advances down the path into the primeval jungle. Your voice trembles.
Mom, Skip's all right. Skip's all right. He's all right. Skip's all right.
Mother's voice is strained, high.
He always comes through here. I tell him not to, but those darned kids, they come through here anyway. Some night he'll come through and never come out again.
Never come out again. That could mean anything. Tramps, criminals, darkness, accident. Most of all, death. Alone in the universe. There are a million small towns like this all over the world. Each as dark, as lonely, each as removed, as full of shuddering and wonder. The reading playing of minor key violins is the small town's music, with no lights but many shadows. On the vast swelling loneliness of them, the secret damp ravines of them, life is a horror lived in them at night, when all sides, sanity, marriage, children, happiness, are threatened by an ogre called death. Mother raises her voice into the dark.
Skip? Skipper?
She calls.
Skip! Skipper!
Suddenly, both of you realize there is something wrong, something very wrong. You listen intently and realize what it is. The crickets have stopped chirping. Silence is complete. Never in your life a silence like this one, one so utterly complete. Why should the crickets cease? Why? What reason? They have never stopped ever before, not ever. Unless something is going to happen. It is as if the whole ravine is tensing, bunching together its black fibers, drawing in power from all about sleeping countrysides for miles and miles, from dew-sodden forests and dells and rolling hills where dogs tilt heads to moons, from all around the great silence sucked into one corner, and you at the core of it. In 10 seconds now, something will happen. Something will happen. The crickets keep their truce. The stars are so low you can almost brush the tinsel. There are swarms of them, hot and sharp. Growing, growing, the silence, growing, growing, the tenseness. Oh, it's so dark, it's so far away from everything. Oh, God! And then, way, way, off across the ravine.
Okay, Mom! I'm coming, Mother!
And again.
Hi, Mom, I'm coming, Mom!
And then the quick scuttering of tennis shoes paddling down through the pit of the ravine as 3 kids come dashing, giggling, your brother Skipper, Chuck Redman, and Augie Bartz, running, giggling. And the stars suck up like the stung antennae of 10 million snails. The crickets sing. The darkness pulls back, startled, shocked, angry, pulls back, losing its appetite at being so rudely interrupted as it prepared to feed. As the dark retreats like a wave on a shore, 3 kids pile out of it laughing. Hi, Mom! Hi, Shorts! Hey! It smells like Skipper, all right. Sweat and grass and his oiled leather baseball glove. Young man, you are going to get a licking, declares Mother. She puts away her fear instantly. You know she will never tell anybody of it, ever. It will be in her heart, though, for all time, as it is in your heart for all time. You walk home to bed in the late summer night. You are glad Skipper is alive. Very glad. Far off, in the dim moonlit country, over a viaduct and down a valley, a train goes rushing along and it whistles like a lost metal thing, nameless and running. You go to bed, shivering beside your brother, listening to that train whistle and thinking of a cousin who lived way out in the country where that train is now. A cousin who died of pneumonia late at night years and years ago. You smell the sweat of Skip beside you. It is magic. You stop trembling. You hear footsteps outside on the sidewalk as Mother is turning out the lights. A man clears his throat in a way you recognize. Mom says,
"That's your father."
It is.
There's a short story called Night, written by Ray Bradbury, read to us by KBOO's own Emily Young. What an amazing job. Great job. This has been Gremlin Time. Stay tuned for Far Away Places. We'll be back again next month with the Bedtime Radio Show for grown-ups.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Native Artist and Storyteller Symposium on Saturday, October 26th from noon to 6 p.m. at the PSU Native American Student and Community Center in Portland. The Native Artist and Storyteller Symposium will feature artist talks and presentations by Native artists, a panel discussion, a community meal, an artist marketplace, and more. Again, that's the Native Artist and Storyteller Symposium on Saturday, October 26th from noon to 6 p.m. at the PSU Native American Student and Community Center, 710 Southwest Jackson Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Portland.